Welcome to you all. Thank you for coming, despite a beautiful spring evening. This is the seventh Miliband lecture on inequalities, dimensions and challenges, the seventh of this academic year. It's been an excellent series, but one of the things the series has presupposed up until now is that inequality matters. It matters along a whole number of dimensions. But the question we're going to ask tonight is a very fundamental one. Does it, and how can we say that it does? And what is the upshot of that in some respects? I mean, inequality is clearly one of the most contested issues of our time. But recently, a number of especially European social democratic governments have tended to argue, especially our own here, that it's not inequality per se that counts, but poverty and marginalization. That the agenda of public policy, economic policy, social architecture should be directed at alleviating the position of the worst off, and incentives should be kept intact for those who are wealthy and very prosperous to continue to enjoy wealth and prosperity. So the debate about whether inequality matters versus whether one should focus on poverty and exclusion and marginalization is a very contemporary one. It yields highly significant policy agendas and differences in the policy agenda, and I think is an absolutely critical matter. We were going to have, as you probably know, three speakers this evening. Ed Balls was also to join us, but he's a parliamentary candidate. He worked closely with Gordon Brown for a long time at the Treasury and has been called away, not surprisingly, by the elections. I would say in passing, as he was called away, I thought to myself, no more politicians, because every time we've tried to have one here at these meetings, they've always been called away. I think that's probably less to do with them as individuals and more to do with the exigencies of political life. But we are very honored and pleased, at least I am, to have Thomas Pogge and Robert here this evening. Thomas Pogge has worked at Columbia since the early 80s to give you a range of his interests. He's taught graduate courses in moral and political philosophy, global justice, philosophy and economics, human rights and professional ethics, among other topics. He's published four very important books, numerous essays and articles, over 80, has given public lectures, it says here, in 250 public lectures in over 23 countries, an extraordinary record. He is a philosopher, he thinks about public issues, he writes about these, and he speaks broadly about these concerns across the world. Robert Wade scarcely needs introduction. He is our own, as it were, professor of political economy and development. His work focuses on how to improve development prospects in today's globalized world. He's particularly concerned with the international system of rules, regimes, and organizations that constrain and yet sometimes make possible development. He's concerned with how to improve the mix of rules and regimes, and he's interested as a result in economic growth, inequality, poverty, the working of international capital markets, among other topics. He is also, of course, the author of numerous books, publications, and has made a huge contribution to these areas. Both Thomas Pogge and Robert Wade have greatly influenced my work. It's true to say I've been inspired by both of them, drawn on both of them in the things that I write about. I'm indebted to them, and I'm sure by the end of the evening many of you will feel indebted as well. So please join me in welcoming them both. Thomas will speak first for about 25 minutes, and Robert will then speak for another 25 minutes. There may be a brief exchange, and then, as usual, it'll be over to you.
Okay, I will speak about global inequality, inequality across the globe. And what we have here is sort of a rough division of the world's population into three groups. Namely, on the one hand, at the bottom, the people living in the rich countries, about 16% of the world's population. And on the right-hand side, 44% of the world's population who live below the World Bank's $2 a day poverty line and live in what's called severe poverty. And I will basically be talking about the inequality between those two groups. Now, to give you a sense of what it means to live below $2 a day, I've got a little hard to take in little slide that shows you how these poverty lines get calculated. Basically, the poverty lines that the World Bank is using are defined in terms of US dollars of 1993, and they are translated into other currencies on the basis not of exchange rates that you get at the bank, but on the basis of purchasing power parity, so-called. That's a somewhat flawed method, largely because the purchasing power parities are based on the prices of all goods and services in proportion to their share in international consumption expenditure, whereas the global poor obviously consume only a very small sliver of these goods and services, namely basic foodstuffs essentially, which are cheaper in the poor countries, but not as much cheaper as purchasing power parities would suggest. So these numbers, in my view, are often the poverty problem is a good bit larger than the World Bank would have us believe. But let's take the numbers of the World Bank at face value for now. Roughly, you can say in a typical poor country, the currency amount that you get when you change your dollars in the bank, the currency amounts are worth or buy roughly four times more in these poor countries than what the purchasing power parities would suggest. So poor people on average have about a quarter of the income that they would have if you took the corresponding dollar amount and exchanged it at the bank into local currency. So in the United States today, for example, to count as severely poor by the $2 a day standard, you would need something like $1,043 per person per year. In a poor country, something around $260 is deemed sufficient to reach the $2 a day poverty line. So that means that on the whole, the people who live below $2 a day really don't take up much of the social product, have a very small share of the social product, as you can see here on the next slide. The 44% of the world's population living below $2 a day have roughly 1.2-1.3% of the global product, now calculated in terms of exchange rates, to indicate the avoidability of poverty, whereas the people living in the rich countries, the industrialized countries, somewhere around 16% of the world's population have 81% of the global product. Now, if you brought all the people living below $2 a day up to the $2 a day poverty line, that would take roughly 0.9% of the global product. And if it were done entirely at our expense, it would mean that we would go down from 81% to 80.1%, and they would go up from 1.3% to 2.2% of the global product. Now, that's just a little background information about the situation with regard to global inequality. And I now want to suggest that there is an impact that inequality has on the shaping of the rules, and for that reason, inequality tends to entrench itself, tends to be reinforcing. So inequality leads to differences in bargaining power, differences in expertise, which then will manifest themselves in tilted or skewed rules of the game that in turn aggravate inequality further, and so lead to a downward spiral. The best figures from recent years that we have come from this wonderful website by the World Bank. Again, I'm taking for the sake of this argument the World Bank's figures for granted, even though I also dispute them on the basis of these PPP calculations. But what you see here is a pretty straightforward correlation in terms of how much in real terms the incomes of various percentiles of the world's population went up. I hope you all know what percentiles are. Basically, the second percentile here, pretty much at the bottom of the global income hierarchy, had no gain over the 11-year period between 1990 and 2001. And as you go to higher and higher percentiles, you see that they gained more and more. So inequality was increasing in that period. And the highest gains were with the high-income nations, which came ahead at somewhere around 3.2-3.3% growth in real terms on average over this period. Here you can see the cumulative impact on these various percentiles and the industrialized countries. And you see that, again, the second percentile over the entire 11-year period encountered basically no gain at all or a completely negligible gain. Other percentiles did somewhat better, and best of all did the industrialized countries. So global inequality is clearly increasing, and that at a reasonably rapid rate. This is also a long-term trend. Unfortunately, we don't have these statistics about global inequality, namely individuals worldwide. We don't have these statistics very far back. But we have statistics of this sort that talk about international income inequality, namely inequality in average incomes of countries worldwide. This particular statistic gives you the quintile inequality ratio, which is the ratio between the richest countries and the poorest, defining each group in terms of 1/5 of the world's population. So you take all nations, order them in terms of per capita income, and then take from the top of that list as many as you need to make up 1/5 of the world's population, and from the bottom ditto, and form the ratio between those two. And you can see that that ratio was about 3-1 in 1820, and then increased to somewhere around 74.1 in 1996. It's recently been declining, not because inequality in general is in decline, but because the increase in global inequality among individuals worldwide has shifted from an international to an intranational increase. So in the moment we have a period of rapidly increasing intranational inequality in almost all countries, we do not anymore seem to have increasing international inequality, at least in the last few years. Now, you have two tendencies here. Globalization, as people say, lifts, you know, the average income in the world. The average human being has a higher income than they had at the beginning of the globalization period. But there's a countervailing tendency of increasing inequality, which is countervailing insofar as the global poor are concerned. And the two tendencies lead to a standstill on the poverty front. There's not much happening with regard to the eradication of poverty, much contrary rhetoric notwithstanding. Again, these are the official World Bank numbers. And you can see here that there's a slight drop in the number of extremely poor people defined in terms of $1 a day. But all of that gap and all of that drop and then some is attributable to one country, namely China alone. With regard to $2 a day poverty, a somewhat more reasonable measure of poverty, you find that poverty has in fact increased. The number of poor people has in fact increased by 10.4%, which is roughly in line with the increase in the world's population, which was slightly larger. Now, this inequality is one that is what we might call a radical inequality, namely one where the people at the bottom of the inequality are really very severely deprived and very badly off. As you can see in statistics like the following that are taken from the most recent Human Development Report, which is always published once a year by the United Nations Development Program, you see here that both in absolute terms and in relative terms, very large numbers of people are severely deprived, lacking adequate nutrition, clean drinking water, shelter, and so forth. So the problem is really a very large problem, and the inequality, therefore, one that becomes increasingly morally unacceptable in light of the fact that given the enormous inequality, poverty would be quite easily eradicable. Perhaps the most dramatic statistic of all is the statistic of poverty-related deaths. You have something like 18 million people dying every year from poverty-related causes, which is about 1/3 of all deaths. The reason that this number is so high is in part the fact that many more than 1/5 of all lives are lived in the bottom 1/5 of the human population, because their longevity, of course, is much shorter. People die, live much shorter lives, die much more quickly. So many more than 1/5 of all deaths and lives correspondingly are lived among the very poor in the bottom fifth. So it's a very significant problem. You can see this also by comparing the number of poverty-related deaths with the number of government-sponsored violence deaths. Here you have a flowchart for the 20th century, and you can see that these deaths, wars, civil wars, and government repression peak at around 8 million, 8.5 million in the middle of the Second World War, and the sum total for the entire 20th century comes to about 200 million. Here you see that compared these kinds of government violence deaths in columns 2 to the bottom, compared with the number of poverty-related deaths just in the last 15 years, and you see that the latter figure dwarfs the former by a considerable margin. So many more people have died from poverty-related causes in the last 15 years than have died from government violence of all sorts in the entire 20th century combined. Now, so far, I've said that there is a lot of inequality, a lot of poverty, but I also wanted to say that this inequality has a kind of self-entrenching, self-reinforcing effect. And that is something that's very often denied. Very often it is said that the inequality is simply a byproduct of better or worse policies that are pursued in the rich and poor countries respectively, and poverty therefore has local causes. Here's an example. My teacher John Rawls, in both his Amnesty lecture and his book, The Law of Peoples, writes that the causes of the wealth of a people and the form it takes and so on, and gives these local explanations for poverty. This is a completely commonplace picture of the world, one that you also find very heavily represented by development economists, who are not so much inclined to deny that external factors play a role with regard to the poverty trajectory of a particular country, but they simply don't discuss these factors. They discuss endlessly what domestic factors, what national factors, play a role in the either the eradication of poverty or its persistence. And that discussion, of course, is interesting and important, but they don't discuss with anything like the same energy the global factors that also play a role in the persistence of poverty. And of course, I don't want to deny that national factors play a role in cementing and increasing this inequality that we observe. All I want to say is that global factors also play a role, and that these global factors in turn reflect the underlying inequality. So one thing that greatly impresses people when they make the argument that poverty has local causes is the great discrepancies in poverty trajectories that you find in the various developing countries. It's an argument that's often made by people who say that look at country A and country B, who were equally poor as of 1965 or whatever, and look at where they are today. One country has come up very quickly and has achieved very good rates of economic growth and poverty eradication. Other countries have done very poorly, and isn't it quite obvious that national or domestic factors must be at work in explaining these inequalities in growth trajectories? The answer to that is yes, that is obvious, and I agree with the argument, but it doesn't follow from that argument that therefore global factors are unimportant. A quick way to see that is by analogy. You find at the end of a class that you teach that students are doing differentially well, some have done much better, have learned a great deal, others have learned very little, and then of course student-specific factors must be at work in explaining the differences among the students. But it doesn't follow from that that the teaching ability of the teacher, the quality of the teaching, the quality of the classroom, and so on, are irrelevant. It's quite possible that a better teacher would have led to a much better performance by all of the students. And it's also quite possible that had the teacher not been such a sexist, for example, the women students would have done much better, and so forth. So the argument shows indeed the great relevance of national factors, which I wouldn't for a moment want to dispute, but it doesn't show at all the irrelevance of global factors. Now that's a purely negative argument. It's an argument that just says it doesn't follow from the great trajectory differences among developing countries that global factors are irrelevant. Now I have to say something positive to show that they actually are relevant, and that inequalities, pre-existing inequalities, play a role in explaining the global factors and their impact on increasing and aggravating global inequalities. Here's a beginning of such an argument. You can see this is a quote from The Economist magazine, which is beyond all suspicion of being ever so slightly sympathetic to any views I hold, and so it's always a good thing to quote. And what they say here, this is not something they would ever say in their sort of op-ed part, but it's something that they did say in their reporting part, how in shaping the WTO agreements in the Uruguay round, of course, there were enormous differences in bargaining power between the big countries and the small countries, and also enormous differences in expertise, and how these differences in bargaining power and expertise then worked their way through into rather skewed agreements that allowed the rich countries to grandfather in various kinds of market protecting mechanisms such as anti-dumping duties, tariffs, quotas, export credits, subsidies to domestic producers, and so on, which are by now very well known to have a very deleterious effect on the export opportunities of poor countries and therefore on the economic development of their populations. You can see this here. This is another pillar of the establishment, Nick Stern, chief economist of the World Bank, also making the point that these various market protecting mechanisms that the rich countries enshrined in the WTO agreement have very pernicious effects on poverty eradication in the poor countries. even if some countries are doing very well, there aren't enough export opportunities for the poor countries collectively to grow at anything like the rate at which the most successful of them, like China in recent years, for example, have been growing. Now, there are various other features of the global institutional order that likewise reflect the bargaining power of the various countries and are also presumably aggravating inequalities among them. And I'll just run through a few of these features quickly. One is the rules, again, part of the WTO agreement, the rules, TRIPS rules, intellectual property rules, which are okay as far as I'm concerned with regard to software and music and things of that sort, but have a tremendously bad effect in regard to pharmaceutical innovation. Basically, the way pharmaceutical innovation is incentivized is by giving inventor firms monopoly pricing powers for 20 years and even more under recent bilateral agreements that allow evergreening of patents and so forth. And with these 20-year monopolies, a company can recoup its R&D investment by charging very high prices, prices that are much higher than the marginal cost of production, and thus allow these companies to make a very healthy profit on their innovative drugs. The downside is twofold. On the one hand, that these drugs are priced much higher than the marginal cost of production and therefore become unaffordable to poor populations. And the second impact is that no pharmaceutical company will do research on diseases that affect predominantly the poor, because from the poor you can't charge these monopoly prices and therefore you cannot recoup your investment in the way in which you can from the rich. So the consequence is then that, as it says here on the last, in the last sentence, of the 1,393 new drugs approved between 75 and 99, only 13 were for tropical diseases, and of those 13, actually 5 were first developed for veterinary purposes and were then found to, as a matter of fact, also be useful for human beings. So that's another little bit of the international rule system that benefits the rich countries, because of course, in most of the important inventions, they get there first simply because they have more capital and better research and so on and so forth. And they demand, as a condition of market access to their much more important markets from the poor countries, that the poor countries enforce their intellectual property rights and basically force their populations to pay their share for these new inventions. Now, it's often said, well, what's the alternative, right? Either we have new drugs, in which case we have to give monopolies to the inventor firms, or we will just simply not have new drugs, and would you want that? Well, there are very obvious alternatives, alternative rules that we could have. For example, a system under which inventor firms get incentivized and rewarded on the basis of the difference that their new drug makes to the global disease burden. So you basically, through the tax systems of all the various countries in the world, you get together a global pool of incentive money out of which pharmaceutical inventor firms get rewarded in proportion to how much their drug, how much of a difference their drug makes to the global disease burden. That would instantly change the entire incentive structure. It would give the pharmaceutical companies a great interest in the diseases of the poor, because that is where a lot of money can be made, where the global disease burden can be very dramatically reduced. And it would also align the interests of the inventor firms with those of the generic companies that often copy their drugs and sell them cheaply, because inventor firms would now want to encourage the generics to do exactly that, because the more drug is distributed and the more cheaply it's distributed, the more of a difference it makes to the global disease burden, and therefore the more money the inventor firm will make. So they're perfectly good alternative ways of shaping the global rule system in a way that would be more friendly to the poor, would eradicate disease to a much higher extent, and would still incentivize pharmaceutical research. Anyway, we can discuss some of these things in the discussion. I just wanted to run by a few of the examples. Here are two more. Under the present rules of the game, there's no attempt to internalize the externalities that the rich countries and their companies impose through pollution and resource depletion. And again, there could be a mechanism that would capture these externalities, internalize them, and indemnify poor countries and poor populations for these externalities. And another relatively obvious reform of the global institutional order would involve global minimum wage and global minimum working constraints for factory work or work of any kind in the poor countries, which would prevent that race to the bottom that we see now, where various poor countries are outbidding each other by offering ever more exploitable and ever more helpless workforces for foreign investment. Last point I want to make is that not only do the global rules of the game that are shaped to our advantage have a pernicious direct effect on the distribution of income and wealth worldwide, one that aggravates inequality and aggravates poverty, but they also have a very pernicious effect on the national institutional rule systems and governance in the poor countries, which in turn then have a terrible effect on the development of poverty in these countries. And here in particular, I want to highlight the privileges that are called international resource borrowing treaty and arms privileges, which basically mean that under the existing global order, any person or group exercising effective power in any developing country is recognized as entitled to sell the resources of that country in the name of the whole country, to borrow money in the country that future generations have to repay, to buy arms in the name of the country, which are most often used for internal repression, and to sign treaties in behalf of the whole country. And that, irrespective of whether these governments, so-called, these rulers, have any kind of domestic legitimacy, irrespective of how they came to power, and so forth. Now, these privileges are extremely convenient for the rich countries and their citizens, because we can basically buy resources from anybody who happens to hold power in these countries, no matter whether they have the slightest legitimacy, no matter how they got to be in power, no matter whether they spend any of the money we pay for these resources in a way that benefits their local population. These privileges are also extremely advantageous to the rulers of those countries, who can keep themselves in power with the money that they get from us, either by borrowing or by selling us their resources. They can buy arms from us to cement their rule, and they can put the rest into Swiss bank accounts and live happily ever after. But these privileges, these very deeply entrenched conventions of our international order, are extremely disadvantageous to ordinary citizens in many of these poor countries who suffer repressive and corrupt government, and of course, no improvement in their living standards. So even the factors that we here in the rich countries most like to adduce as evidence that poverty and severe inequality as we find it in the world today are due to local factors, namely the corruption and oppression and brutality of many of the regimes reigning in the developing countries, even these factors have their root in good part, I would suggest, in features of the global order for which we are especially responsible. Thank you.
Well, anyone hoping for a stand-up, knock-down fight between Thomas and I will be disappointed. You can think of the relationship between what he said and what I'm going to say as the strands of a double helix. There are points of difference, and there are many points of similarity. I, too, am going to talk about the global context rather than the United Kingdom context, even though I imagine many of you in this election season would much sooner hear about what's happening in the United Kingdom. But the point is that even if one's interest is in UK or Europe, one's understanding of what is happening here has to be consistent with one's understanding of what is happening in the rest of the world. But before I come to the rest of the world, I do want to say just one point about Europe. It's quite germane, actually, to my larger argument. Within Europe, there is one region which has a much lower after-tax income inequality than the rest. And this same region, with much lower income inequality than the rest, also has much better economic and social performance by a variety of yardsticks, such as economic growth, such as labor productivity, such as research and development, and several other things, physical and social infrastructure as well. The remarkable thing is that European governments and the European Commission give almost no attention to this part of Europe as a model for the rest of Europe. They, the governments and the Commission, remain fixated on the United States as the model of a virile capitalism that Europe should be aspiring to. This part of Europe is, of course, the Nordic countries. On the face of it, the much better performance of the Nordic countries combined with greater income equality in the Nordic countries than in the rest of Europe suggests that a relatively equal income distribution is compatible with relatively high economic growth and high labor productivity and those other indicators of economic performance. So that's sort of by the way. I want to now come to the global context. What I'm going to do is to spend most of the time setting out what I call the neoliberal argument about these matters, the neoliberal answer to the question, does inequality matter? And then to go on and make a critique of that argument, and then to draw some of my own conclusions. But I want to begin with the big picture. I do think that this is a useful way to complement Thomas's pie charts of just thinking about what the world looks like, so to speak, from the moon, where this is population, this is per capita income of countries. So these areas here indicate the population of countries living at per capita incomes ranked along here in purchasing power parity terms. And so obviously you get this huge mass of the world's population living down here at very low per capita incomes, and this tiny little pimple of population living up at the top in the United States. Here would be Western Europe. This would be United States, Japan. Here would be Western Europe. South Korea would be somewhere down here. There's this strange and totally unexplained missing middle. And then you have the so-called emerging market countries down here. And so this immediately raises a number of questions, like what is the magnitude of the distance between the top and the bottom? What is the overall degree of inequality in this distribution? What are the trends? What is the magnitude of poverty right down at the bottom, what Thomas was talking about? How many people are living on some international poverty line down here? What are the trends in the number of people living down here? This is the shape for, I think, the late 1990s. What would this look like if you went back to 1960, 1970, 1980, and so on? These are the kind of questions one has to ask. Before I come to income, I just want to make 2 points about non-income measures of inequality. Namely, first of all, life expectancy as an index of the distribution of health opportunities. The bottom line on life expectancy is that the inequality of life expectancy at birth fell dramatically through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and then that improvement in life expectancies in the low-income countries down here, that improvement came to a screeching halt in the 1990s, so that now, today, the inequality of life expectancy at birth in the world at large is as great as it was in 1960. In 1960, with countries not weighted by population. And specifically, the gap in life expectancy measured in years, the gap between North America and Western Europe on the one hand and Sub-Saharan Africa on the other, that gap is greater today than it was in 1950. So in the 1990s, the previous improvement in life expectancy as an indicator of broad health has deteriorated quite a lot. Second non-income measure, education. The bottom line here is simply that if you measure education in terms of years of schooling, which of course is an extremely bad indicator, but if you use years of schooling, then there has indeed been very dramatic convergence upwards. Years of schooling in these low-income countries have increased quite fast relative to years of schooling up at the top. So that's the good news, but sub-Saharan Africa again lags behind, and so does South Asia. Okay, all that is sort of leading up to my main subject, which is this. It has to do with inequality trends in income and expenditure. And while what I've been talking about is not particularly contested, this area of inequality trends, just the trends, never mind what are the causes of the trends, this is the mother of all inequality disputes. There is a strongly worked out argument that I call the neoliberal argument, or since some people that I have in mind don't like the word neoliberal, one could just say the liberal argument for short. And this argument has been, in fact, the dominant approach to public policy in these domains in developed countries and in developing countries over the past 25 years. It's especially well established in the what I call the GEMS, the Global Economic Multilaterals, GEMS, like the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, and so on. And it's well presented, very well presented, articulately presented in Martin Wolf's recent book called Why Globalization Works. It provides the same argument, the liberal argument, provides the framework of Jeffrey Sachs's book, The End of Poverty, discussed in this room a couple of weeks ago. This same argument, the neoliberal argument, also provides the core of the World Bank's latest world development report called Equity and Development. This report, which you can download on the web, it's due out in June, but you can get hold of this copy now. This report uses basically the same argument as its conceptual spine. What I want to do now is to set out the key propositions of this argument, and then go on to explain why I think it's either wrong or misleading. So the first proposition is that, yes, inequality does matter, but it's inequality of opportunities, not of outcomes, as in income distribution. It's what matters is equality of opportunities to earn income, opportunities to have education, opportunities to get health, not the actual outcomes themselves, with one exception, namely the outcome of extreme poverty. So the liberal argument says public policy should be directed towards equalizing opportunities for the good things in life, including income, but not equalizing outcomes, but it should also be at the extreme end of outcomes, oriented towards removing extreme poverty. So that's proposition number one. Inequality does matter, but it's really inequality of opportunities that is the problem. The second proposition has to do with the empirical trends in poverty and income inequality. And the argument is that the empirical trends are favorable. Broadly speaking, looking at the world as a whole, the world is moving in the right direction, namely that the poverty headcount has fallen dramatically over the past 25 years or so, having been increasing for the previous 200 years, so that there has been a dramatic reversal of historical trend poverty headcount, meaning simply the number of people in the world living on a per capita on a purchasing power parity income of less than $1. That's the World Bank's measure of extreme poverty, less than $1 a day. So that the number of people has fallen dramatically by something like 400 million. Thomas said it was a small fall, but certainly in World Bank eyes, that's a very big fall since about 1981. So that's good news. The world is moving in the right direction. And the second piece of good news is that income inequality between countries has also fallen in the past 25 years or so. And that fall in income inequality between countries also reverses a 200-year trend. So therefore, the world is moving in the right direction. And the third proposition has to do with causality. And this neoliberal argument says that the main cause of this fall in inequality and poverty is globalization. Globalization meaning increased economic interdependence between countries, such as rising trade to GDP ratios, rising investment to GDP ratios, rising financial flows to GDP, and so on and so on. That's what the indicators of globalization are. And the second part of this third proposition is that the main reason, or a major reason, for this globalization, the increasing economic interdependence, major reason is that the world has moved towards free market policies over the past 25 years, thanks to the efforts of organizations like the World Bank and the IMF in their structural adjustment lending. These organizations are pushing a series of microeconomic reforms aimed at moving developing countries towards free markets for products, free markets for finance, for labor, for everything. So the agenda is the agenda, which is called the Washington Consensus Agenda, refers to trade liberalization, privatization, financial liberalization, movement towards floating exchange rates, all these things. And the liberal argument says that these microeconomic reforms have been the main drivers of globalization. Globalization has been the driver of this dramatic improvement in the world economy. And so the implication of all this is that going forward, the world simply has to do more by way of globalization. The global economic multilaterals, the GEMs, have to push forward with the same kind of liberalizing programs they've been following for the past 25 years or so. But Africa is acknowledged to be a special case, and Africa needs a variety of sort of special measures, as long as they don't include anything to do with protection or industrial policy or those kind of things. All those measures are remain strictly out of bounds, even for Africa. Now, I have to say, in case you think I'm setting up a straw man, if you go and read Martin Wolf's book, Martin Wolf is probably the most influential economic journalist in the world, and you will see in his book, Why Globalization Works, an argument which at its core consists of the propositions that I've been making. You can also find it, of course, every week in The Economist. Now what I want to do is to present very schematically, and in some haste, very schematically, some evidence that runs against this argument. And the first evidence concerns the big trends in economic growth. If the liberal argument is right, you expect to find a substantial increase in economic performance, as indicated by economic growth, since round about 1980. Why? Because the whole world has shifted in a neoliberal direction, thanks to the efforts of the GEMs and American graduate schools of economics and so on. So policy has shifted in the right way, and you expect to find an improvement in economic performance. And so the question is, what do you find? Well, one of the big facts of our time is this. There has been a dramatic growth slowdown, quite contrary to the liberal predictions, between, say, 65, 79, and 80 to 98. This is median GDP per capita growth rate. In the OECD countries, you can see the slowdown from 3.5 to 1.8. And in the developing countries, the slowdown is from 2.4% median to, and I put a question mark there just to see if you can guess what the answer is. I won't even delay to elicit answers. But the figure here is about zero. So there has been a very dramatic growth slowdown in the OECD and in developing countries, and the slowdown in developing countries is even more than in the OECD countries. And that really does run contrary to the liberal expectation. The second set of evidence, contrary evidence, has to do with poverty. If you take the World Bank figures at face value, then, as you remember, I said and Thomas said that there has been, according to the World Bank, a fall in the poverty headcount, the number of people living on less than $1 a day. Since about 1980, that reverses the historic trend. As Thomas pointed out, the trouble with that is that the result depends entirely on China, if you take the figures at face value. And if you also take the figures at face value, but you use not $1 a day, but $2 a day as the international poverty line, then there has been a substantial increase in the number of people living on less than $2 a day, which implies, if you take the figures at face value, that there's been a real bunching of people between $1 a day and $2 a day. Now, $2 a day is obviously extremely poor. So even by World Bank figures, taking them at face value, the poverty trends are not in the right direction. And thirdly, the third point to make is simply that the bank figures clearly have a large margin of error. This is something that Thomas and a collaborator, a bright Indian economist named Sanjay Reddy at Columbia, have spent a great deal of time, measured probably in years of their lives, elaborating this point that World Bank statistics have a very wide margin of error, and they are probably biased downwards in this sense. If you define an international poverty line not in terms of a rather arbitrary dollar number like $1 a day or $2 a day, but rather in terms of calorific requirements and coupled with demographic characteristics, calorific requirements enough to ensure that people have basic well-being, that is, get out of poverty in that sense, then the poverty headcount is substantially higher than the World Bank figures. For example, ECLA, the Economic Commission for Latin America, did a study using, on the one hand, a poverty line based on calorific requirements and availability plus demographic characteristics, and then the World Bank poverty line of $1 a day. And the ECLA study found that the poverty rates for Latin American countries were of the order of 3 times higher than the World Bank figures suggested. So that's what I mean when I say that the World Bank numbers are probably biased downwards. There are more people living in what we would recognize as extreme poverty, many more people than the World Bank numbers suggest. So that's another bloody nose, if you like. That's another bloody nose for the liberal argument. Now on to inequality trends. This is a point that Thomas made, if you use the inter-country Gini coefficient, that is, you take all the Gini coefficients for individual countries, you do not weight them by population, then you find that this Gini coefficient for the world, inequality has widened very rapidly, since 1980. That's not good news for the liberal argument. And secondly, if you take the international Gini coefficient, which is countries' per capita income weighted by population, so China and India account for a great deal of this figure, then this international inequality has fallen since 1980. It has fallen, and that's good news. The trouble is that the results depend entirely on China, on one country. And the coefficient actually goes up quite dramatically if you exclude China. And I'll just show you quickly what happens. So this is the Gini coefficient for the world, including China, this line here. And lo and behold, if you go to 1980, you find that after 1980, quite consistent with the liberal argument, the Gini coefficient fell, indicating increasing equality in the world at large. But even if you take this measure, which is most favorable to the liberal argument, you find that if you exclude just one country, it goes up like a July the 4th skyrocket. Inequality is going up, not down, if you take out China. Of course, I have no objection to China. The point is simply that if the result depends on just one major country, you can't really say that a general process of globalization is driving a general process of falling inequality. It depends on just one country. It would be more likely to say that a general process of globalization is driving a general increase in inequality, with the major exception of China, which of course is not following a globalization or a Washington consensus set of policies. And the third point to make about inequality is this one, that there are other plausible measures of inequality which show a widening. And one plausible measure is this, which is the income per head of regions such as Latin America or Africa, regions as a percentage of that of the North or the OECD countries. And so you can see from 1950 to 2001, Latin America has experienced a very dramatic fall in the proportion of its per capita income to that of the North. But the South overall has also had a fall. Africa, of course, dramatic fall. The one exception is Asia. This Asia line includes China. I've taken out China just to show you that the reason for the upturn in Asia here is mainly because of this very dramatic upturn in China. So all this is some rather stylized evidence that is not good news for the liberal argument. I want to say something about the effects of inequality, because obviously the question, does inequality matter, comes down to not only what is happening to inequality. Is it getting worse? Is it getting better? If it's getting better by itself, there's no need for action. If it's getting worse, maybe there is need for action. But the question is, what are the effects of inequality? Well, there are a number of propositions. One of them has to do with inequality and growth. And the proposition is that higher initial levels of inequality cause slower subsequent economic growth. So countries with very high inequality, like Latin American countries, will show slower economic growth, other things being held constant. But in fact, there is the evidence for that proposition, which champions of equality would like to have confirmed. The evidence for the proposition that high inequality leads to slower growth is not strong. There's just too much noise in the relationship. However, if you look at inequality and poverty reduction, there is a strong relationship in this sense, that higher economic growth causes falls in poverty. Higher economic growth is good for poverty, but the more unequal the income distribution, the lower that effect of growth on poverty is, so that countries with high inequality, for any given rate of economic growth, will have less poverty reduction. So if you're concerned with poverty reduction, then you better be concerned with inequality. Similarly, one can ask about the evidence on inequality and democracy. Does high levels of inequality go with unstable democracies? Well, the evidence is suggestive that lower equality countries have more stable democracies. The evidence is suggestive, but it's not strong. There is, however, strong evidence on crime. And for anyone who is keen on the question of how to persuade elites in our countries, in the G7, to think more seriously about inequality, this strong relationship between inequality and crime is a good one to use. And basically, the evidence is, I don't have time to go into it, that higher levels of inequality on a national scale are associated with higher levels of various kinds of crime. And therefore, the argument to the rich is, if you want to enjoy your riches and comfort, maybe you should be prepared to have somewhat higher rates of progressive taxation so that there will be less income inequality, and in the long run, you or your children will have a more pleasant life, less free of crime. In any case, the point I'm making is that that there are good reasons why we should be concerned about not just equality of opportunities, but also equality of income outcomes, not presuming that an equal income distribution is desirable, but that there is a very large proportion of the world's population living in countries where income inequality is so unequal that a whole lot of measures of economic performance would be improved if there was a move towards greater equality. Well, one could take this next into the question of why it is that the world and the G7 in particular, and the G1, namely the US even more particularly, why these governments are so committed to this neoliberal agenda for the rest of the world, especially for the rest of the world, when the evidence for it is seriously contestable. And that would lead me then into a story about what has been happening to US and also UK income distribution. The bottom line of that story is that there has been a tremendous increase in income inequality, especially at the top levels, the top 1%, the top 0.1%, the top 0.01% of the US income distribution since about 1980, since the Washington Consensus reforms, since this whole agenda of market liberalization kicked in. There's been a tremendous increase in the share of the very top groups, the top 1% or less in the US and the UK, their share in household income distribution. And the relationship between that increase in their share of the total and this liberal agenda, the relationship is simply that the owners and managers of capital live mostly in the top 1% or so of the income distribution, and they see it as very much in their interests that the whole world should move to open trade, open capital markets, free access to countries like in China for American banks, British banks to go and set up business. It's very much in their interests. They see this as the way by which they can continue to increase their share of national income. Anyway, I can elaborate on that if anybody wishes. Let me just make one main conclusion, and it is this, that we have to move, in terms of public policy, we have to shift at the level of norms. towards recognition of the norm of special and differential treatment for developing countries. This used to be an important norm in the GATT, but since the WTO was established, not just since that, I mean, in the whole ethos that has prevailed in the world since the 1980s, with structural adjustment lending, the Washington Consensus, and so on, the whole ethos has been hostile to that norm of special and differential treatment for developing countries because they are developing countries. Rather, the norm is they are just like us, except they're poorer, and therefore all they need by way of special and differential treatment is longer adjustment periods, somewhat longer adjustment periods. Instead of having 5 years to introduce the new patent, international patent regime of the WTO, they get maybe 12 years, but they have to do it because they're just like us, only a bit poorer. What has to happen is a change at the level of norms such that the following story does not take place. And the story concerns Mongolia. What happened in Mongolia is that, let's just take a couple of minutes. What happened in Mongolia is that after 1990, the fall of communism, power in Mongolia was occupied, was taken by a group of Mongolians who really, really believed what they'd been taught at the World Bank Institute about radical free market reforms. And so almost overnight, they removed tariffs and all other forms of protection. The existing industrial sector, although admittedly inefficient by world market standards, had helped to secure very good social indicators for Mongolia relative to its income level, very good. The industrial sector was wiped out almost immediately. But even this government wanted to retain one industrial policy measure, which was an export tax on unprocessed wool to give encouragement to Mongolian wool processors to process the wool in Mongolia. Well, they wanted to keep that export tax, but the Asian Development Bank came along and said, we will give you a big, big loan on one condition, which is that you remove the export tax on unprocessed wool. And so the government said, yes, 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 and remove the export tax. The result is that even that industry collapsed. Now all Mongolia's unprocessed, now Mongolia sends its unprocessed wool to China. China's mills do the processing. Scroll forward to 2002. A mission from the German Development Bank was in Ulaanbaatar talking to the government about Mongolia's accession to the WTO. And in the course of discussing this matter with the World Bank country director, they just mentioned, well, what about the possibility of putting on an export tax again on unprocessed wool? And the World Bank country director got very upset. And he said, that would be going backwards. We want to encourage the Mongolians to have and to stick to completely free trade. Even though if he just looked out the window, he could see the impact of completely free trade on the Mongolian economy. Well, I could tell a very similar story about Sri Lanka and the World Bank in Sri Lanka, an equally bad story, but I've run out of time.
I'd like to go to the audience straight away and ask you for a cluster of four or five questions. And where are the mics? I'll just take two from down here, then two from up the top. Anybody here?
Hi, thanks. I was interested in Professor Poggi's suggestion that
you're leaving, can you please not talk? Thanks.
I was interested in Professor Poggi's suggestion that there should be a global minimum wage. I just wanted to know what he thinks of the argument that that would then discourage firms from investing in the developing countries at all and encourage them to stay just in the rich world.
Question in the middle?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to play the devil's advocate if possible and ask the question that wasn't answered in either of the presentations, which is, why does inequality matter? We've been convinced that there is a lot of inequality, but does that mean we should have pity for the poor? Should we give more charity? Should we institute a regime of global redistribution? I'm not quite sure what we're supposed to do with this information from a moral perspective.
One more question in front. Wait for the mic, yeah.
Isn't inequality important because it affects the incidence of economic risk? The wealthy have the capacity, in effect, to insulate themselves from economic risk. But that risk hasn't gone away, perhaps. It's been externalized onto other agents in the global economy. Isn't that, if we look at things in terms of risk and risk management, isn't that really the central, brings out the central importance of inequality?
I wanted to ask you both, you mentioned the liberal argument. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
The key to this, the problem with the liberal argument, and I think The Economist mentions this a lot, is that it carries on to talk about freedom of labor and freedom of movement of people, as well as freedom of movement of capital and goods. And that isn't being carried out even where those other elements are being carried out. So the liberals might argue with you that their argument hasn't been carried out in itself either. So it's difficult to tell whether it would actually work or not.
One down in front.
I wanted to focus on the main question, which, does inequality matter? And I think you've given us a lot of reasons to see inequality as instrumentally bad, in the sense of that it's a sign of the fact that we could eliminate poverty. It sometimes contributes to poverty. You mentioned it might be bad for growth. We can imagine it being bad for social relations, for the democratic system in countries. I wondered, though, whether you think that it's bad intrinsically, in and of itself, economic inequality. And I think that the liberal argument is misrepresented. If you put the first premise to be concern about inequality of opportunity, I'd want to say, if you read the Economist, they say, look, inequality has no intrinsic disvalue. It's only, all we care about is eliminating poverty, perhaps social exclusion and all these things.
When you say inequality, do you mean inequality of outcomes, like income or of opportunities?
Either way, I think that the focus in the liberal argument is on how badly off are the poor, on eliminating poverty, etc. Well, anyway, so two questions. One is, does it have any intrinsic importance in economic inequality? And the second is, isn't the liberal argument better put as it has no intrinsic importance, we should just focus on eliminating poverty?
Let's take one more question.
Yes, I'm just wondering, both of the speakers seem to focus a lot on economics and on norms. So we heard Mr. Pogge talk about possibly raising taxes in order to do something about these problems. We heard him talk about patents and the like. We heard Mr. Wade talk about the interests of that very tiny group, less than 1% and so on. And we heard him talk about changes in norms. And he also seemed to suggest that there was very little in international economic bodies to alleviate these problems. I'm just wondering, wouldn't the speakers perhaps also think that the real solution, even if one analyzes the economic problem correctly, the real solution lies not in the economic or value realm, but in the power between states and really in the political realm?
I think we'll just take one or two more because time is short, so let's get a few more things, and we need to address another inequality.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, what do you think would be the added value of incorporating human rights framework to development issues, and what would be the implications of poverty reduction strategies?
Anybody who hasn't spoken, who wants to raise another question? Yes, please.
You mentioned cat being made of China, that is actually 20% of the world's population, so that's not exactly insignificant. What I was actually going to ask, also, as I understand it, the indicators in India have been improving in recent years, and perhaps they could comment on that. In that way, you've got something like 40% of the world's population where things are definitely improving. Africa, everybody seems to leave as a sort of a bit of a special case. Another chunk is Latin America, but still there seem to be major improvements in large chunks of the world. Southeast Asian countries, several of those are still doing quite well. The other one I was going to mention is that, you know, they mentioned the thing when Robert was talking about the thing on distributions of incomes and things. If you do look at the international coefficients, Gini coefficients, one's always struck by, apart from the Scandinavian ones that are low, the other ones that are always low are still the Eastern European ones. How does one sort of equate this with exactly what we're talking about? Was actually that a better system because it was more equal? And incidentally, the thing on life expectancy, I think, is one of the reasons that life expectancy has dropped a lot is probably due to the particular impact of AIDS in Africa, but also it's dropping very rapidly in parts of Eastern Europe.
I'll allow one tiny extra follow-up.
Speak up.
He has an income of, forget the picture, he has an average income over that period of, say, $1,000, but his income varies very widely. And in the second country, a person has an income of, say, $500, but that is absolutely rock solid, guaranteed. Which of those individuals would you think?
Anyone burst into? Oh, yes, please. Let someone burst.
Do you think that the rich get more self-interested as they become super rich? And is that a reason why inequality matters at the top end?
Can I just follow up one question before we give it back to you, and that's China. Are the lessons of China's extraordinary development generalizable? That is to say, some people have talked now not about the end of the Washington consensus and the emergence of a so-called Beijing consensus. But do you, from the work that you've done, think that there are policies, structures, and elements of Chinese development that actually can be generalized to different contexts? If so, why? If not, why not? And what lessons should we draw from that? Okay, do you want to have 3 minutes each, and then we'll have... I want to leave the audience with a minute or two, so we need to finish at 8. So 3 or 4 minutes each, all right. 4 minutes each to highlight the main points.
David is having a good day. He gives us 4 minutes. All right. Number one, the global minimum wage. And why will this not discourage investment in the poor countries? It will not do so because the labor share in the final end prices of these products that are imported from the developing countries is extremely small. It's for the most part below 10%, in some cases above 10%. But by and large, very, very small. And so if that small share gets increased, let's say, by 10, 20, 30, 40%, you will increase it, let's say, from 8 to 9% or something like that. And that will still not, in very, very few cases, make a difference to whether it's more lucrative to produce in a poor country or in a rich one. Second, there were several questions on why does inequality matter, and we should talk about it. And I want to start with this idea of it being bad intrinsically. I think the word intrinsic is ambiguous between a narrow meaning and a broad meaning. The narrow meaning is if it is just the case, even though nobody knows it, that there is an inequality. So there's one person over here, another person over there. They have different life prospects or lead different lives, but neither knows of the other. So here you might say, well, that's the kind of thing that we have in mind, where there's nothing further. There's just the intrinsic fact that there is an inequality. And then I could agree that, or at least for the sake of the argument, I'm perfectly willing to agree that it doesn't matter or doesn't matter very much. It might be nicer if they were at the same level, but it isn't a big deal so long as they're both well above the level of sufficiency. But of course, in the real world, these are not the cases we have at all, right? In the real world, it is importantly true that people know of one another's prospects and know that other people are very much richer than they are. And this is the country in which important studies have been done on how very important relative poverty is, namely the feeling of being less well off and so on. And Wilkinson did a big study, others did a big study on this. So you find that going through various grades, I don't remember all the details, but going through various grades of public officials, you find that as you go up the various grades, even minute differences make a difference in perceived happiness and life expectancy and so on. So what matters greatly, I think, is this perception, and that could be part of an intrinsic, you know, depending on how you define the word intrinsic, you could call that an intrinsic thing about inequality, but you could also call it something extrinsic, namely where inequality is combined with the knowledge that you are at a particular level in the income hierarchy. The same thing, of course, is also increasingly true internationally, because people, even though they're very poor, they know quite well that we are incredibly rich compared to how poor they are, and that we don't give a damn. And that by itself, the fact that we are very rich and that we don't care, is something that has a depressing effect on people's lives in the poor countries. One other thing I should say about this, does inequality matter? The main point I wanted to make is that inequality matters greatly with regard to the shaping of the rules that then influence not only the future income and wealth distribution, but also many, many other things, right? The rules are shaped as it now goes, the rules of the world economy, but also the international rule system in general is shaped by the rich and for the rich, because their bargaining power and their expertise that they can bring to the bargaining table simply overwhelms the bargaining power and the expertise of the poor. If they get represented at all, very often they're represented by very rich, very corrupt, very brutal regimes that speak in their name and exercise what are called the treaty privilege in their behalf. That leads to skewed rules. Now, the important insight here is, and that's maybe a point of sort of a slight refinement that I want to add to what Robert said, that when we think about globalization, it's a big mistake to think about globalization in terms of pro and con. There are the people in favor of globalization, there are the people against globalization, and if you're not in favor, then you must be against. Very wrong picture. I'm, for example, very much in favor of globalization in terms of opening markets and having more interchange and the various measures that Robert indicated would be good measures of globalization. But the important and interesting question is, under what rules should globalization take place? And here we have an incredibly complicated option space, just billions and billions of options as to how to design, for example, an intellectual property regime and so on. You can see that from the fact of how big that treaty has become. I think it's now at 43,000 pages. It's a very, very big treaty where all sorts of things are specified and designed.
Is this the TRIPS?
The WTO treaty, with all the with all the attachments and all the various parts of it and so on. So it's an enormous treaty work, where all sorts of decisions, all sorts of parameters, millions of parameters have to be fixed one way or the other. And so the various countries go to the bargaining table, and very often the outcome is one, or in almost all cases the outcome is one, that benefits the rich countries and reflects their interests and their ideology and so on. And the cumulative result of all these millions of decisions that go into the treaty framework is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, in not just economic terms, but in many other terms as well. So that's a very important effect of inequality. And of course, you see something like that domestically as well. You see that in the United States of America, for example, where the rich can buy themselves political influence quite legally through organized bribery of Congress people, senators, and presidents, through the campaign contribution system, you find that policy over time reflects the interests of the rich. And they get more than what they put in. They get it back in terms of subsidies and various other political favors, which in turn aggravates political inequality and economic inequality as well. So that's why inequality matters. It's corrosive of any kind of communal working out together what fair rules would be. That gets me to the question of whether the people, the richer they get, the more self-interested they get. I don't think so. I think that at least most of these pernicious tendencies that I'm talking about can be explained simply by the fact that they get richer. They get more able to act on their self-interest, to implement it, to get it reflected in the rules.
And your last point is?
No, I've got three more.
I've got okay.
Very quickly, yeah. Human rights framework, I'm all in favor. My book had the title World Poverty and Human Rights. So I was trying to bring a human rights framework to bear on the problem of global poverty. I wasn't talking that much about poverty and human rights simply because we were supposed to talk here about inequality. India and China are improving. The important thing here is, and that's again a sort of point where I want to refine a little bit Robert's statistics here, is the important point is we shouldn't think, especially in this day and age of globalization, in terms of countries, and countries are coming up in the world, they're doing better or they're doing worse and so on. What's happening, much of what's happening in terms of inequality these days is happening within countries. So if you go to China, I've gone to China very, very often since 1987, and there's an incredible increase in inequality within China. You have some streets that are, you know, New York and London are put to shame by the incredible luxuries that you find on Nanjing Lu in Shanghai, for example. And then you find incredible poverty right next door in the Hutongs, in the little, you know, shanty towns. So there's a tremendous increase in inequality globally. If you take China as one blob on the screen, it's going up very nicely, thank you very much. But poverty is, I think, larger than the official statistics show. We have, for example, very, very bad data on China because China doesn't voluntarily want to participate in these poverty measurement exercises. And even if one follows these data, yes, poverty has declined rapidly in China, but relative poverty has gone up very much, and many, many people are very discontent and very desperate about finding themselves very, very much below other people. Personal domination, which had been eradicated in the Cultural Revolution Zone, is coming back in a big way in China. The poor get pushed around and treated like dirt by the rich and so on. So it's not all rosy what is happening in China. Now, one other thing that I wanted to say about China
is
that...
This is your third point. I'm counting.
Yeah, so it's the last one then, right? So the last point then on China, or the last point altogether, is that we have to bear in mind that China's success, you know, the liberals want to try to present China and say, look, everybody could have done as well as China has done. But one has to remember that all these developing countries are competing for the same heavily protected rich country markets, and China's success has in many ways been necessarily been the failure of other countries. So as we have these quotas and tariffs and so on, heavily protected markets, China got in there in a big way because they have a tremendous labor cost advantage, they have a tremendous economies of scale advantage, they can basically crank out anything. If you want a million, they can do it. If you want a billion, they can do that too. Other countries have suffered as a result of China's success. That's not China's fault, of course. It's the fault of these heavily protected rich country markets. But the more successful China has become in the 1990s, the more other countries, like Bangladesh, for example, have suffered because their export opportunities were competed away by China. Okay, I can't say more, right?
So just a couple of quick points. One, it goes to the heart of what this session has been about, why does inequality matter? My position is simply this. I make a distinction between the moral and intrinsic arguments about inequality, whether it matters, the moral and intrinsic arguments on the one hand, and on the other, the instrumental arguments. You can, quite apart from the moral and intrinsic reasons, you can say that inequality matters in terms of the effects of inequality on other things, the costs on other things that are considered to be desirable, such as low crime or high economic growth. And that seems to me to be a viable distinction. The second point on China, what are the generalizations that can be made? I broadly agree with what Thomas said, but I would add, China teaches that the Washington Consensus Agenda, which emphasizes the causality from microeconomic reforms of a market liberalizing kind to more efficient resource allocation to higher economic growth. That's the argument of the Washington Consensus. That argument is a mistake in the development context. What China shows is that macroeconomic, two points. One, macroeconomic stability is more important than efficient resource allocation, coupled with the second point, which is that macroeconomic policy must be aimed at increasing the rate of investment, and that means, amongst other things, capital controls, so that you can have an autonomous monetary policy, so that interest rates are not set in relation to the world market and the preferences of foreign exchange traders, but are set in relation to your development needs. You can do that if you have capital controls, as China has, but China is coming under lots of pressure to remove its capital controls, not least from the US Treasury. And similarly, going with capital controls, a non-liberalized financial system such as China also has. Both of these two things are important, and they are both more important than the kind of microeconomic reforms that the Washington Consensus tries to get all developing countries to adopt. Those are the lessons of China.
Well, as I said from the outset, I've learned a lot from the work of these two, and I hope this evening has been stimulating and engaging for all of you. There's one last lecture in the Miliband series, the night before the general election, on culture inequality. Oh. It will be given by Richard Sennett. I think it'll be a splendid evening. He's a wonderful speaker. It'll be analytical as well as lyrical, and you should definitely come. So I look forward to seeing you there, and once again to our speakers, many thanks.